Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's September 28th, 54 degrees with some rain clouds outside the weather window. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's Bob Bedour. Good morning, Bob.
Well, good morning. And yes, those rain clouds are here. And unfortunately, they'll be sticking around for a little bit. We also have a cold front coming in. So let's go down this week and tell you what's happening. Today, we're going to have a high of about 76. But as you said, those rain clouds are there. Those are going to be increasing in their chance for showers throughout the night and continuing all through the night. Good chance we'll be seeing some showers, as we'll be seeing lows drop down to about 50. Then Thursday, that chance for rain is going to be increasing, as we're going to be seeing good chance those showers just stick around, as we're going to see those clouds. Basically, there's a swirl pattern that is just keeping everything in Bay, and northeastern Utah is pretty much where it's sticking. So you can see a good chance of showers during the day, and then Thursday night, got a good chance of that. Once again, we're going to see showers throughout the night. As Thursday, we'll see a high of about 72, then drop into a low of 45. But there's also a cold front coming at that time, as that temperature, like I said, dropped down to 45. But on Friday, where we still have showers continuing on through the day and night, we're going to see a high of only about 63, so dropping almost 10 degrees from Thursday to Friday as that cold front comes through. Keeping those showers in place, we'll receive a low of about 40 on Friday evening and the showers. But then Saturday, things start clearing up a little bit, as we're going to see high coming, staying down low with that cold front, about 61. That low Saturday night into 41, but still those chances of showers continuing. But finally starting to get a little break in things Sunday, as we see sunny skies returning. A slight chance of showers as that storm is getting ready to finally head east. Might see something happening to you Sunday night, as we've got a high starting to raise back up now to 64. And then Monday, it all starts to clear up completely. Monday, we should see sunny skies with a high near 66, overnight low in the mid-40s, and then Tuesday, sunny again, temperature raising back up again to 78. So again, we're going to see some showers hanging around today, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, maybe even a little bit Sunday. Temperatures dropping quite a bit, especially over the weekend, but then we'll see those sunny skies and temperatures start to raise back up as we start our work week next week. We just have to get through this little bit of a storm we have.
Okay, Bob, thanks.
Thank you.
It's Bob Bedour, KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Stuyterville Basin Planning Commission Chairman John Kuchera. He'll be recapping last night's discussion and public hearing regarding the Harmon's application at the Outlets Park City. Later on, author Paul Anderson and documentary filmmaker Connor Hagen discussing their book and film that deal with the vital role of community activism in charting the future of a community. And finally, the Division of Wildlife Resources Division Law Enforcement Captain Chad Bettridge discussing the poaching problem, this before the start of the general hunt season, as well as their new drone program and how that might be able to help. Also, stay tuned coming up on the Mountain Life right after the local news hour. Today's guests include Dr. Michael Chen, the new OBGYN at Intermountain Park City Hospital, and later on, Dr. Michael Roizen, the chief wellness officer at the Cleveland Clinic, talking about the Great Age Reboot, cracking the longevity code for a younger tomorrow, in which he offers a look at the future of longevity. Stay tuned. It's 8:10 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Taking a look at some local news now. Violence, bullying, and weapons in school worry parents and students across the country. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has this update on Park City School District's safety protocols.
School shootings in the U.S., a student assaulting a classmate at Treasure Mountain Junior High School last year, and the recent altercation between a student and a tennis coach have put student safety in the spotlight. Carolyn Sinan is Park City School District's chief student service officer. She said the district has hired full-time social workers for Ecker Hill Middle School, Treasure Mountain Junior High School, and Park City High School this year. Elementary schools share two full-time social workers 2 to 3 days a week between all four campuses. classes. Sinan said the most critical safety mechanism for children is to talk to a trusted adult if they have concerns about their safety or the safety of their classmates. She said the social workers are trained as interventionists and know how to handle situations where students feel unsafe.
We get into these situations where we didn't know, so we can't help the students solve it or solve it on our own if it needs to come to that. We have such a great staff here in Park City School District that I feel like they know. They've been here, they know the students, and they can tell, but also our students are vocal. They ask for help, and if they don't, we're trained to look for those signs.
One area of school safety that the district is still working on is building security. Park City School District Chief Operations Officer Mike Tanner is in charge of facilities. He said principals must keep all outside doors closed and locked during school hours. The open campus at the high school has students coming and going all day long. Some junior high students walk from Treasure to the high school for classes throughout the day. Tanner said that's been a concern for years. He said students have doors propped open as they come and go. He said the Uvalde massacre was a reminder of the importance of securing school buildings.
The takeaway from Uvalde was that the perpetrator gained access to the school through a exterior door that was opened. And so, obviously, if we could have all the protocols in place to protect our kids, but if there's one break in the chain that's designed to keep them safe, that being an open door, all that work is for naught.
The district now uses software that alerts the high school front office when a door is left open anywhere in the building. Some restricted doors have very loud screamer alarms, and Tanner said those act as deterrents to students. He said preventing weapons from being brought into school involves a variety of safety measures, and the most critical violence prevention is kids speaking up if they suspect any threats.
You know, we've looked at potentially some unobtrusive type screening devices, similar to what you would see at an airport, but we're not sure that the community here is ready for that yet. The biggest thing is putting eyes on kids as they walk into the schools, and I think the other piece of it too is the internal threat assessment that we've put in place to hopefully get wind of that kind of stuff before it ever manifests itself into a kid walking into the school with a weapon.
Tanner said if a student uses the Safe UT app to report an anonymous concern, it immediately goes to law enforcement and the school district. He said the district also scrubs school emails for keywords. Monitoring outside social media, he admits, is complex, but he said the community plays an essential role in keeping kids safe in school.
If parents can just encourage children to be a part of their own safety by if they see something, mention something, by pulling the door shut if they see one open, by if they hear of anything that potentially could compromise the safety of their friends or the school, to just let a counselor or a teacher or a principal know, it'll be met with the confidence and we'll get the child the help that they need.
Tanner said studies of school shootings and violent episodes show that most often threats had been circulating through social media before the events occurred. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Hello, this is David Lawson with the Lawson Real Estate Team, powered by eXp Realty. Having served Park City's real estate transaction needs for 22 years, we are honored to be able to support KPCW. Whether you're looking to buy, sell, or invest in real estate, our local agents are here to help. More information on ABC4 TV's Real Estate Essentials show or at LawsonRealEstateTeam.com.
It's 8:15 now. Good morning. Well, don't be alarmed if you see emergency vehicles and personnel running through Park City this morning. A full-scale exercise to test Park City's emergency evacuation plan will be happening from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. today. About 60 volunteers alongside organizers from Park City Fire, Park City Police, Utah Highway Patrol, Summit County Public Safety Dispatch, and the Utah Division of Emergency Management will all be taking part in the drill. A convoy of some 60 vehicles will be leaving Lower Deer Valley and head toward Richardson Flat at about 10:30 this morning. You may want to stay away from that. Police officers will be stationed at major intersections along the route to direct traffic. An AirMed helicopter will also be taking part in the drill, and fire and EMS will also respond to a simulated incident at an unnamed commercial location within city limits. Because it is just a drill, residents should not contact emergency services. And again, that's getting underway this morning at 9 a.m. Well, as the affordable housing crisis escalates across resort communities, Aspen Skiing Company is doing something about it. The ski company is offering free season passes to those with rooms to rent if they'll lease to the resort's seasonal employees. Aspen Skiing Company has relaunched its Tenants for Turns program. Jeff Hanley, Vice President of Communications for Aspen Snowmass, says the program offers incentives to homeowners willing to rent a unit, a guest house, even an extra bedroom to an Aspen Snowmass employee.
We're undergoing a housing crisis. Has been as long as I've been here, and I've been here 30-something years, so it's worse than it's ever been now. So we got creative.
If there's a bed to rent, Aspen Skiing Company, through the Tenants to Turns program, is offering a full season's pass, 10 single-day lift ticket vouchers, or a $1,200 gift certificate valid for any Aspen Snowmass product. Hanley says one tenant equals one season's pass or equivalent product.
So anything that we control, we're offering landlords that bonus on top of the rent they get that they would agree upon with our employees. So the way we run it is we push it out there, landlords touch base with us. We have a list of employees who are looking for lodging. We put them in touch and let them work out the detail. Once a lease is signed, we can then go forward and provide that incentive for the landlord for doing that.
This incentive is available for new leases that take effect after October 1st. Landlords who participated last year and sign a new lease for the coming winter are also eligible. Hanley says working with the county's employee housing program, the resort knew that there were 3- and 4-bedroom units that had only had 2 people living in them because children had either moved on or tenants had moved out.
So we thought, wow, there's a lot of empty bedrooms out there. Let's see if people are willing to rent them if we throw in a little sweeten the pot a little bit for them.
About 40 employees were able to find a room last season through the program. Hanley says that they hope to increase that this year. Aspen has just over 750 beds that it owns and operates for seasonal employees, but it's still short by about 250 for the 1,000-plus employees that they hire every winter. Lease terms are between landlord and resort employees, but must contain some basic parameters, and leases must be for longer than 6 weeks to trigger the incentive package. KPCW reached out to Deer Valley and Park City Mountain Resorts to find out if they have considered something similar. Senior Communications Manager Emily Summers said Deer Valley is always exploring programs and incentives that support their employees. As housing continues to be a challenge in the community, Summers said ways to increase options nearby the resort is one of their highest priorities, with many possibilities currently being evaluated. Park City Mountain Resort Senior Manager of Communications Sarah Huey said she was not aware of whether something like Tenants for Turns had come up for discussion with resort management. KPCW News Time now, 8:19. It's 8:20 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. The Snyderville Basin Planning Commission held a public hearing and possibly scheduled to take action on the Harmon's grocery application at the Outlets Park City. On the phone to tell us what happened, I have the chair of the Planning Commission, John Kuchera. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Leslie.
Did you get a good turnout from the public?
We didn't have that much input from the public last night. I think we had only one person over the phone, and that's probably because there are a lot of businesses surrounded in the area, and so we didn't, but we hope to get some on the next meeting when we have one.
Okay, so you didn't take any action on this?
That's right. So this was a request for redevelopment for the Outlets Park City to add a Harmon's grocery store. And we had a couple of items that were outlined by staff and concerns by commissioners to basically the applicant will work through with staff to try to come back and improve this project as proposed.
Yeah, what was the one comment then from the person who did call during public input?
It was traffic oriented, and you know the level of traffic would be on some of the back roads by the Powderwood condominiums and around there. Basically, the demand coming from a new grocery store in the area, what that would look like.
Okay, so it seems like lots of folks love the idea of a Harmon's, but not in that location. I mean, where we're talking about a mile away from 3 other markets: Fresh Market there at Pinebrook, Whole Foods down the street, and then Smith's across 224. Did you hear from the applicants about why this is the location they want?
We did, and I think, you know, it was also a concern of the commission and staff. The idea is certainly to create some demand and vibrancy of the outlets, number one. Number two, you know, Harmon's is a operates throughout Utah. They've been in a variety of different competitive markets, and they've found that, you know, being close to other grocers tends to bode well for everyone and brings everyone to the area. And so, you know, I think ultimately, you know, our job is to probably let the free market decide. And if they believe that they can be, you know, a responsible, good operator there, then that's the place that it would go. You know, there are also only so many places where, you know, this size of grocery store could fit. And this is certainly one of them.
Right. There were several requests for exemptions. They need a larger building. They'll be demolishing about 72,000 square feet and then rebuilding it, asking for that 72,000 square feet, except that that's, there's a, you know, code requires a maximum of 60,000 square feet. They also need a taller building. They're asking for a 42-foot high building. The height limit is 32 feet. They're also requesting 31 fewer parking spots, even though the outlets today lack about 200 parking spaces. So are they trying to put a square peg in a round hole here?
Well, I think that was a little bit how they described it. I would say just on a couple of the items, you know, the height, they're requesting 42 feet. There is a grade change that mitigates some of the visual impact. Staff indicated that, you know, this could potentially be appropriate in the town center. We have other buildings of that height based on the overall project. So that wasn't an overall, you know, major concern. Regarding the big box, the 60,000 square feet, basically the code says, you know, there need to be substantial, tangible benefits for the general public. This is a 59,000 square foot floor plate with a mezzanine above, sort of has a, you know, cafe type environment. And along with the other attributes, is that something we can overcome? You know, they're going to continue to work with staff and come back on that. Let's see. And the other items,
parking,
you
spots?
Know, traffic. Parking spots. Yes, I think that's actually they're actually overparked by 200 parking spaces, and that was in the staff report, and I think it may have been reported incorrectly. But they actually are overparked according to their square footage. So removing some of those parking spaces, you know, would comply and wouldn't be a problem, was my understanding from last night.
Okay. There was also concern about transit. Does the applicant have a plan that would work?
They went through traffic in sort of engineering on our side. I think it's something that we're still looking at closely. You know, one issue was certainly the traffic and level of service drop. The traffic study indicated that there would be an area that would need some mitigation. So staff and the applicant are going to review options, possibly paying something like impact fees and bringing, you know, known problems to get fixed earlier that would help with that. And in terms of circulation, I think they're still working on that as well, but they would have, you know, the plan would be for direct bus access very close to the grocery store itself, where you could do onloading and offloading of, you know, sort of pull out of the main traffic. So I think those items are still being worked on, but there is a general plan.
All right. So how do you see the planning? Where's the Planning Commission leaning here, thinking that this might, if you can work things out, it might be a good idea?
Well, I think, you know, I think the Planning Commission overall was constructive. There were definitely concerns. I think the applicant's making, you know, a strong effort to mitigate many of those. I think a big issue was the compliance with the Kimball Junction Master Plan. You know, there, a lot of work was put into that by the Planning Commission, Council in the past, and things like connected neighborhood, walkability, pedestrian-oriented environment, mixed-use neighborhood, housing options, public realm, all of those things. Are important to make this, you know, first redevelopment, you know, in the town center really work. And so I think if those, that bar can be met and those features can be added and really make a world-class town center, I think the Planning Commission will likely be constructive on it. And that's what I heard last night. But there are a handful of things that need to be overcome.
Okay. So what happens from here then?
I think the next step is the applicant and staff are going to work on the items that were sort of outlined as issues last night. It'll come back to the Planning Commission ultimately for a recommendation on this, the spa, the specially planned area that we would be recommending to council. And basically that would go on to council, where there would be an opportunity for additional public hearings. We would also be doing a recommendation on a development agreement, which would come before us next, but I think they're trying to kind of do this piecemeal. So there should be opportunity for public input down the road, possibly at the next Planning Commission meeting and certainly at the council level if this continues forward.
Okay, so you do expect it to see it come back shortly here, huh?
I would expect, we definitely expect to see it coming back, and, you know, I'm not sure if it would be at the next meeting or the following, but it would probably be on the agenda fairly soon.
Okay.
So stay tuned there.
All right. Hey, anything else that the Planning Commission's working on, busy with?
We have a retreat coming up at the end of, next month, and hopefully go over a handful of items and, code revisions and trying to get together on some of the big picture stuff. So we'll determine a little bit more of that later.
Okay. John, appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
John Kuchera is the chair of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:28. 8:28 now, good morning. Well, you may have noticed some downed power poles and construction equipment along Highway 224 in recent weeks. That's all part of Rocky Mountain Power's wildfire mitigation project. KPCW's Kimberly Flores reports.
As extreme weather events become increasingly common, so does the threat of wildfires in Utah. Rocky Mountain Power, the state's largest electric company, is focusing on preventing and mitigating wildfires, particularly those caused by electric disturbances. The utility is investing nearly $500 million across its six-state system over the next several years to prevent catastrophic fires like those plaguing other western states. Rocky Mountain Power spokesperson David Eskelson said the utility is paying particular attention to those areas where wildfire risk is inherently higher.
We have areas particularly along the Wasatch Back that are of higher risk of wildfire, and we have designated areas where we've identified the elevated risk, and we've taken a number of steps to mitigate that. Changes in hardening to our distribution and transmission systems is part of that. The other part is the installation of our own local weather stations where we can monitor humidity, wind, and other weather factors.
The mitigation project in Park City focuses on updating transmission and distribution lines from the Snyderville substation near the Olympic Park to the substation in downtown Park City.
In this particular case, we are replacing the previous structures, the previous wood poles, with steel, and they're a special kind of steel called Core 10. They're self-weathering, so they'll turn a kind of rusty brown color over time, and then they don't need any other maintenance after that.
In addition to the new power poles, distribution lines, those that carry power to neighborhoods, are being buried underground. Despite the magnitude of this project, Eskelson said customers should not notice a break in their service.
Typically, we try to schedule these things so that we de-energize the portion that we're working on, serve it from other directions, and then that's one of the reasons why we do it, after the peak demand season, because there's an ability for other parts of the system to serve customers while this one is out of service.
The wildfire mitigation project in Park City isn't the only one taking place in Utah at the moment. Rocky Mountain Power began construction in Big Cottonwood Canyon in May to improve overhead power lines along SR-190. That project also includes upgrading overhead systems as well as burying existing power lines. Eskelson said the project in Park City is expected to wrap up in November, and when it's done, service will be more reliable and safer for everyone. Kimberly Flores, KPCW News.
KPCW News time now, 8:30. 8:31 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Leadership Park City and the Park City Film Series are hosting an evening of film and discussion. It's coming up Monday night, October 3rd at the Jim Sani Auditorium. The topic is the vital role of community activism. Joining me on the phone to tell us more, I have author Paul Anderson. He wrote the book, The Town That Said Hell No, Crested Butte Fights a Mine to Save Its Soul, as well as documentary filmmaker Connor Hagen, who made the film High Country. The film will be screened at 7 p.m. and then followed by a community discussion. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Yeah, Paul, maybe start with you. So do you know Connor? I mean, were you aware that each other was working on a book or a film about one another or about Crested Butte?
I probably knew Connor when he was a suckling babe. He grew up in Crested Butte, and I did in a way also, living there first when I was about 18 years old. So I watched the street urchins of the town grow up, and Connor was one of them.
Yeah. Well, Connor, as you mentioned, you're a native of Crested Butte, but what, you grew up in New Mexico, and when did you make the move?
That's right. I was born in Crested Butte, moved down to Taos, New Mexico, when I was still pretty young. I was 3 when I moved down to Taos, but we would always come back to Crested Butte and visit, you know, numerous times a year because my parents' core friend group was up in Crested Butte, and so it was always like a second home to me. And I actually think that's kind of what gave me the perspective on Gunnison Valley to be able to make the film was getting that distance from it.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, but why focus your film on Crested Butte? Why not Taos? Where are, you know, the other places?
Have you been to Crested Butte?
Yes.
Yeah, that's partly why. It's to me, it's just one of the most magnificent, you know, unique and beautiful places on Earth. And I just think that there's just a really strong community there. There was something that was happening back then in the, you know, 70s, and I think it was very unique, the sense of camaraderie in the community and the sort of shared sense of environmental stewardship. And so I found the stories that I heard coming out of that era in Crested Butte fascinating. And I wasn't hearing stories about anywhere else. You know, it was basically because my parents had lived there for so long.
Sure. Paul, I believe today you call Aspen home, but you did live, as you mentioned, in Crested Butte, then graduating from Western State University there in Gunnison. At what point did it come to you that you wanted to tell the story of Crested Butte and that Crested Butte and the community fighting the powerful mining company?
I was compelled to tell the story after the town had defeated the mining company, AMAX. And to say that is a little bit of an exaggeration. The town put up a huge front, which was amazing for a small, eclectic, and really often dysfunctional community to rally its citizenry together and really form an effective cohort out of a rabble. So when I saw that happen and the transformation that town went through, the political affirmation of democratic principles, really, of self-determination and autonomy for a small community against a huge external force, I saw that as a real lesson, I think, for America and the world to recognize the importance of self-determination for a community. I mean, that's what Ukraine is doing right now. Crested Butte did it on a much smaller scale and without quite the gravitas, but it was still a pitched battle to defend itself against an external threat, and that was a special story for me.
Yeah. What was the fight about?
All right, so Crested Butte had been a mining town. Historically, it was a coal mining town in the Elk Range of Colorado. And the coal that was mined there fueled the steel industry for a company called Colorado Fuel and Iron in Pueblo, Colorado. And that industry ran in Crested Butte until 1952. It started in the late 1880s. It ran until 1952 when less expensive, more available sources of power were found to fuel the blast furnaces for the steel industry. So Crested Butte shut down after 1952, and the railroad pulled up its tracks, and the town is really left very isolated. It felt like a frontier community. And when I first saw it in 1969, it was like a museum diorama. So it was beautifully untouched. The streets were dirt. The people who lived there were either offspring or the actual coal miners who had been there, and they were of Eastern European descent. They were Serbo-Croatian, mostly. So there was a real culture there that was like a foreign land. It was an amazing place to stumble into.
as a young person looking for America, so to speak. So the town was just barely getting by. There was a ski area there, but it was always on the fringe of bankruptcy. People were struggling for income, and a group of people came in like me, often cast-offs from urban areas who wanted a change of life, and settled into this beautiful, quiet enclave and a cul-de-sac, literally at the end of a highway. Then in 1977 came an announcement that a mine would be built there, a new generation of mines. This was not going to be the pick-and-shovel mom-and-pop type mining that coal mining had been. It was going to be a huge industrial complex where the treasure was an ore body of molybdenum, and molybdenum is a steel-strengthening alloy. An ore body of molybdenum that totaled 300 million tons. And the town looked at that and said, are you kidding? Here in Crested Butte? And the company, AMAX, wanted to lay this on the doorstep of Crested Butte as a gift. The town said, hell no, we don't want it.
Okay, so that's, I was going to say, you could have just called your book, you know, the town that said no, but it was hell no, huh?
It was a very strident affirmation that Crested Butte, that we in Crested Butte, who had come to replace the old-timers there, and there are a lot of ironies to this story, but we had determined that we didn't want to have industrialized lives. We didn't want to be part of the military-industrial complex. And so the town, and it wasn't through any necessary coalition that was formed. It just happened organically that people were of a like mind because we had come there for the same reasons.
Yeah. So was this a story that you covered then as a journalist back in the 70s and 80s?
I did. I reported on it from the beginning, first for a newspaper in Gunnison, the Gunnison Country Times, and then later for the Crested Butte Chronicle in Crested Butte. And I followed that event, that issue, all the way through to its completion. And when it was over, I had all my notes and all the articles I had written, and I said, this is a great story.
Yeah, did you need to go back and do other interviews after that?
I did. And, I talked to the mining representatives who were you know, I mean, Crested Butte in a way demonized the mine, but never really demonized the individuals who were proposing it. The AMAX team was a group of respectable, well-meaning people who were really endeavoring to give Crested Butte a new generation of mines, and they wanted to do something special there. So I interviewed them and got their views, and I tried to be as balanced as possible.
Yeah, Connor, tell us, just maybe give us a brief synopsis of your film, High Country.
Yeah, sure. So High Country is essentially about the history of Crested Butte from what Paul's been talking about, from the mining days, the old timers, through what Crested Butte now has become, which is a very different type of place, a tourist town, basically a ski town. But it's not just skiing, you know, it's outdoor recreation, and all that. So, the film is essentially about the transitions that the town has gone through, from being a, you know, frontier coal mining town to becoming one of the premier resort destination towns in the country. And it's all this sort of, you know, ups and downs that come with that. So yeah, it focuses on the period when, Paul's generation, which we like to call the mid-timers, were there. And the decisions that they were making as they sort of, you know, took over the town from the coal miners. It touches on a lot of different points throughout that history, but yeah, Focuses on that era.
Where'd you get all of the footage for the film? Family photos, family videos?
Yeah, we teamed up with the local museum in Crested Butte, and they were our fiscal sponsor, and they provided us with, like 90% of the archival imagery footage and photos. And then we spent a month in Crested Butte conducting 40 interviews with various subjects who had lived in Crested Butte during that time. And, you know, whittled those 40 interviews and all the archival footage down to this film, which is an hour long.
Wonderful. Okay, well, the common denominator in both the book and the film is Miles Reiterman, who, before coming to Park City, served as town planner for Crested Butte. What did he provide to your story, Paul?
Miles, Miles was an incredible coalescing force in Crested Butte. Excuse me. I consider him kind of a Svengali. He wove a myth. He created a persona for the town in a very creative, innovative, imaginative way, and really understood the community and its values. And he brought that to light in a slideshow at the very onset of the fight with AMEX. And this slideshow depicted Crested Butte in a beautiful way. It showed the scenic values, it showed the community values, and then it showed the future by showing photographs of the children of the town. And I'll never forget it, because the slideshow was not held in the town hall or in a conference room. It was held in the Grubsteak Saloon, because Miles knew that the only place people would really convene in a neutral setting was a watering hole like the Grubsteak. And so that's where it was held, and Miles pulled together this disparate community into a unified whole that adopted the same dream.
And for you, Connor, what did Miles contribute to the film?
Just like what Paul is saying, Miles is critical. He was what seems like, you know, the galvanizing force back then. He was really the catalyst for change. I mean, there was a lot of folks involved. Various mayors and various town planners and Paul himself but Miles is, based on my interviews with all these different people that lived there during that time, Miles really was the single person who was looking ahead down the road into the future and trying to make decisions responsible decisions for the town's future. And implementing those policies to basically coalesce the community and try and do the best that the town could to protect and preserve the natural environment. So he was really leading the pack, it seemed like, and he was a visionary, I'd say, back then.
Okay, well, the film
and still is.
Well, Connor Hagan's film, High Country, again, it'll be screened for free Monday, October 3rd. The film starts at 7 o'clock. There'll be a discussion with both Paul and Connor afterward, moderated by Miles, and the community is welcome to attend. We'll look forward to it. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:45. It's 8:46 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, hunters are apparently getting a bit antsy for this year's hunt. According to a press release from the Division of Wildlife Resources, 319 animals have been illegally killed since August 1st. On the phone to talk about what's going on and how the public can help, I have Chad Bettridge. He is the law enforcement captain for the Division of Wildlife Resources. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So this number, 319, those are just the wildlife DWR knows about. Could it be higher than that?
It's possible it could be. And it's important to note that on these numbers, which seem to be a little higher this year, we've had an uptick of some over-limit of fish that have been taken. So that's why this number is bigger. It's kind of an anomaly this year that we've had quite a few cases of some gross over limits of fish that are included in that number.
Is it a food scarcity issue? I mean, people concerned about being able to feed themselves? I mean, what do you attribute that to?
Mostly people just not understanding the rules. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that the people came from either out of state or out of country, came to a local fishery and just started taking too many fish. So
yeah. How do you know that the animals were illegally taken? I mean, did you find the animals, or how does that work?
So for the most part, if an individual goes out and participates in hunting or fishing, and they do it without a license, or they do it in a spot that they're not supposed to be, or they're trespassing, or anything that makes that activity illegal, that animal becomes an illegally killed animal. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So there's lots of different factors that kind of go into play on what an illegal animal is. It doesn't mean that somebody just wantonly went out and shot it and left it. That sometimes does happen, but a lot of times people, you know, either make a mistake, take the wrong animal, or in the wrong location or something like that.
Yeah, so how are you finding them? I mean, there's a lot of open space out there.
Yeah, our officers are out there patrolling all the time, but for the most part, we rely heavily on the information coming in from the public. And a lot of times, the people that do make mistakes contact us, reach out to us, and say, hey, we made this mistake, and we just need to let you guys know about it.
Yeah. If somebody's on private property, can they hunt whenever they like?
No. The season dates are in effect regardless of who owns the property. Because the state owns the wildlife.
Got it. 39 of the 319 animals are considered big game. What are we talking about? Moose, elk, coon?
Yeah, so those would be moose, deer, elk would all be considered big game. 22 of those were deer, and I don't have a lot of information on that. I just ran the stat and have that number, so I'm not even sure exactly where all those deer were illegally taken from. But that is a high number that we're working on trying to cut down.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, what's happening? I mean, do people just feel like they can help themselves? The weather's nice, and they know that the odds are pretty low that they might get caught?
Not necessarily. Like I said, sometimes people go out and, especially during the archery hunt, you know, if you were to see a small buck and, you know, and it's in the midst of a bunch of does or something like that, and you shoot an arrow at it and it's not the greatest shot, and you, instead of hitting the buck, you hit the doe, that doe becomes an illegally killed animal. Things like that can happen. Things like people in the have a tag for this location, but they're hunting in a different location just out of either they didn't understand where their boundaries were, or they're doing it on purpose. So there's lots of different things that can go into effect. While there are people that go out and blatantly do take animals illegally, for the most part, it's not most of the time.
Well, let's talk about that, the blatant, you know, just taking animals, because I had a listener send me photographs of about two elk that were found beheaded, their bodies and meat just left to rot near East Canyon Road, I think just last Thursday. What can you tell us about that?
So I don't have a lot of information on that case. Do you know if that person sent that information to us? I'm not sure of that case.
I guess so, because I have one of the pictures includes looks like a uniformed DWR officer.
So in a situation like that, where somebody goes out and literally just takes an animal for the antlers or something like that, and the meat goes to waste and stuff like that, that's as serious as it gets in the wildlife world. And that's where, you know, a person could be charged with a felony, could end up in jail with some lots of fines and restitution costs and stuff like that. So that's as serious as it gets.
Yeah. So what is it? Is people, they don't want the meat? They just want the rack? I mean, is it, you know, we've
potentially. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's sometimes some people out there that do things like that.
Yeah. I mean, because there's some, you know, rumors going around about local folks bringing big game hunters from across the country, paying thousands of dollars to get onto private property, which they don't know that it's property in which the people taking them have no right to be there. Are you aware of such businesses happening?
Not specifically. We investigate things like that each year. Sometimes we find some validity to it, and sometimes it's a rumor. as far as recent information, stuff like that, I haven't heard of anything specific to that, but it is something that has happened in the past. And again, we take, you know, private property is a serious thing for us. We want to make sure that landowners' interests are protected, as well as the public to be able to go out and participate in these activities. We hold them both.
Yeah, technology is very sophisticated now, and apparently these folks have done their homework. They access property early in the morning or at dusk, undercover, clandestine. They're dressed in camo. They set up cameras. The cameras send data to their phones, telling them where the animals are. It's pretty much guaranteeing a kill.
And just so I don't know if everybody knows, but those trail cameras that are on the landscape that are being used to actively take big game, stuff like that, have become illegal. People are no longer allowed to put the cameras up there with the purpose of taking big game. If you put a camera up on the landscape just for the purpose of photographing stuff like that, and it has nothing to do with hunting, that's still legal. Which is a difficult caveat sometimes, because our officers spend a lot of time trying to figure out which one's which and stuff like that. But situations like you just described, we do have, you know, our investigators are heavily involved in cases like that. At least they have been in the past. I don't know if they have that information that you're speaking of right now. And if they do, they're working. I mean, I would encourage you and tell you for sure that they'd be working in really hard on trying to figure out what's going on in that situation. I just don't have the information on that case right now.
Yeah. The press release noted that since August 1st, DWR has issued 569 citations. So what's happening with these citations? I mean, are people just getting their hands slapped? I mean, and paying fines?
So when an officer issues a citation, it goes into court, and then it relies all everything else after that is on the court system. So we go testify, we tell them what happens, all that sort of stuff. But the final outcome of what happens in that case or in that circumstance is up to the judge. And a lot of times there's fines that are paid. Sometimes they're reduced fines. Sometimes they're dismissed. And all that is up to prosecutors, defense attorneys, and the judges. So our officers don't have a lot of say in what happens after that. But the fines are there in place. They're in code, and the judges, for the most part, follow those fines. So yeah, if somebody gets a citation, they will have to pay a fine, potentially have to pay some restitution. There's a potential that they could lose hunting privileges for a period of time because of that situation. So things like that are taking place as a deterrent. It's just it's a never-ending battle.
Yeah. But when you mentioned that there are some felony charges involved, too, you would think that that would be a little bit stiffer than just, you know, paying a fine.
Sure.
But,
sure.
It's not up to you.
Like I said, a lot of times, so restitution on the animal that's taken illegally, and where people go out and blatantly do take animals illegally or trespass or things like that, we do suspend their hunting privileges for a period of time. Depending on the animal, it can go up to, you know, 7 years to 14 years or something like that, they're no longer allowed to hunt. And that's the biggest deterrence that we have is suspending hunting privileges.
Yeah. There have been reports in the last few years here in the Park City area, there were two cow elk shot off just off the Rambler trailhead off of Old Ranch Road in Round Valley back in January 2020. A month later, six dead elk were found near Bittner Road in February 2020. $1,000 reward put up by somebody here locally didn't help capture them. I mean, are we talking about the same people? I mean, do people just go out and shoot and kill big game?
I don't believe that in those two situations that we were looking at the same people. The one that you're talking about, as far as the multiple bulls, we had a lot of information that came in. We investigated all of that information, and we just couldn't find evidence that would tie that to any single suspect. That case is still open. It's still being worked on. It's just we don't have the information tying one individual or a couple individuals to those illegally killed animals.
All right. Well, okay. Running out of time. I just want to have you tell people how they can help the DWR if they do suspect poaching.
Absolutely, absolutely. We encourage people to call us, and we have a Help Stop Poaching line, which is 800-662-DEER, and they can call that number anytime if they see something that they think's illegal or they know is illegal. People can also download our TIP 411 DWR app and text us. Say they can remain anonymous. They can send pictures. They can send GPS locations. That's a new system that we've had up in the past year, and it's proved to be very effective in getting information to us.
Okay.
So both of those ways are great ways to get in touch with us.
Yeah, and you do just recommend getting a license plate if you happen to see that, but telling people not to confront anybody.
For sure, for sure. We don't want fist fights on the mountain or anything like that. We just want people to, you know, collect a little bit of information for us and let us do the follow-up. Let us go and talk to people and stuff like that. That's our job. That's what we get paid to do. And you know, a lot of times in these wildlife and hunting type situations, emotions can be pretty high, and we want people to make really good decisions and just let us do the follow-up for them.
Okay. Chad, I appreciate your time. Thanks for calling in this morning.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Chad Bettridge, again, is the law enforcement captain for the Division of Wildlife Resources. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:59. It's coming up on 9 o'clock. We've got 58 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. Looks like some of those rain clouds moving past, but there is a slight chance of a shower before noon. Otherwise, another chance of some showers and thunderstorms after 3 p.m. Expected high today of about 76, an overnight low of 50 degrees. Again, another chance of some showers and thunderstorms tomorrow afternoon, a high of 72. Better chances for rain, it looks like, Thursday night on into Friday. Lingering showers Saturday, even into Sunday. And Heber City reporting 55 degrees, again with a 30% chance of a thunderstorm, otherwise a high of 82. 40% chance of some thunderstorms tomorrow, high of 79. And then a 40% chance of some rain, it looks like, on Friday with a high of 71. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City. Stay tuned. We've got headline news followed by the mountain life. This is KPCW Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County, 91.9 FM in Wasatch County. You can stream us live at kpcw.org. You can use the KPCW app and listen to us wherever. You can also ask your smart speaker to play KPCW radio. Time for news.